Live from beyond the Beltway, this is Eric Cohn, filling in for Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Charles Lipson, political scientist and senior professor emeritus of the University of Chicago, and David Masiotra, commentator and author of Exurbia Now, The Battle for American Democracy. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base, AM 560 The Answer, WIND Radio in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. Our phone lines are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289 to be a part of the program with us this evening. A lot to talk about. We have finally reached the week that many people thought would never arrive. Not just the first week of summer, but guys, we are actually supposed to have a presidential debate this week. And for all of the prognostication, for all of the people who thought that this was never going to happen, I guess I should add a moment of hesitation to say there are still 4 days between now and when this is supposed to happen. Probably all the reason in the world to believe it could fall apart at the last minute, considering the political dynamics at play. But as of right now, at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday evening, June 27th, we are supposed to have the first presidential debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. This will be in Atlanta, broadcast on CNN. Jake Tapper and Dana Bash to moderate. Let's start, Charles, here. What are your expectations for this debate, including, as I mentioned, we've got 4 days. Do you still think it's going to happen?
Yes, I do think it's going to happen. And I think that President Biden wanted it early because at the time he was trailing in the polls. It now looks like the polls have tightened up and some even show him ahead. I think that the striking thing about the campaign, don't know how it'll work out exactly in the debate, is how disciplined Donald Trump has been. I think the thing to watch is whether Trump stays on message, and the message would be about immigration, the economy, law enforcement, some kitchen table type issues. And the bad message would not only be personality if he kind of went over the top and so forth, but also if it was very much backward looking toward the last election.
Charles, what do you think the possibilities are that he, you know, put a number on it for me? What percentage chance do you think it is that Donald Trump will spend the majority of his time focused on the last 4 years and Joe Biden's record and the current problem? So I guess that in a way is a little back looking, but still forward projecting and talking about the last administration. And how much is it going to be about the history of 2020 and before, including the presidential election in 2020, which Donald Trump still contends was stolen from him?
I think he'll try to concentrate overwhelmingly, 90%, on the Biden administration. The backward-looking part of that, however, might be lawfare. I mean, I think not only Trump, but according to polls, a lot of the American public thinks that he's been prosecuted in ways that others would not be. And the latest thing that's happened along those lines is that Trump, the man who prosecuted Trump in New York, Alvin Bragg, decided to let all the people who seized a building at Columbia University and barricaded themselves in and wouldn't let the police in and so forth. He dropped everything against them, but he figured out a way to prosecute Trump, and I think a lot of people just think that's unfair.
David Masiotra also joins us. David, good to talk with you again. What are your expectations for this first presidential debate of this rematch of the 2020 election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump?
Yeah, the rematch no one wants. It's the opposite of Ali and Frazier. so it's probably a little difficult to market. Right. And I should say that, you know, I've been on the program with Professor Lipson before, and I really respect his work. But if Trump's behavior over the past couple of months qualifies as disciplined, it's only because of the low bar that Trump's previous campaigns have established. So in the past couple of months, he's referred to the January 6th insurrectionist rioters as warriors and patriots. He's accused Joe Biden of snorting cocaine. He said that immigrants poison the blood of our country. So my expectation is that if Joe Biden can keep it together, and as someone who has every intention of voting for Biden in November, that does make me nervous, that he will attempt to goad Trump into slipping and falling into a viral moment like he did in 2020 when he told the Proud Boys to stand by. If the debate is defined by Trump having an unhinged moment, that's how Biden will triumph. And vice versa, if the debate is defined by Biden appearing confused, that's how Trump will triumph, because we have this really strange and undesirable situation in which both candidates are very unpopular with the American people. So it's more of a question of who does worse rather than who succeeds.
David, and I'm going to get your thoughts on this as well, Charles, but what are your expectations for Joe Biden for this debate? So we saw him not too long ago giving the State of the Union address. So we've seen him deliver, you know, I will acknowledge up front that it's kind of sad to be talking in these terms, but we have seen him speak later in the evening. We have seen him speak for a longer period of time in delivering that State of the Union address. This is the first time that he is going to be matched up in a debate since 4 years ago. A lot has changed since then. I think most people would agree that he does seem to be looking a little longer in the tooth than he was 4 years ago. What are your expectations for Joe Biden in this debate?
Well, I'm hoping that he rises to the occasion, because that's what's happened in the past. The Republicans have made the mistake of setting expectations so abysmally low that if he's able to speak in complete sentences, it's almost as if he's had a smashing success. And some of the Republicans are falling into that trap again. Interestingly enough, not Trump, who said that he wouldn't underestimate Biden as a debater. So, as I said, I'm nervous that Biden will have a moment that is profoundly unflattering to his campaign, because he does appear to have lost a step and slowed down. But if he can perform as he did at the State of the Union and perform as he did at some of these other high stakes appearances, he may surprise people, and he certainly has a better grasp of policy and policy detail than Donald Trump, who's wildly ignorant on these matters. But I'm not sure how much policy still resonates with the American public. This is more a question of theater than political science.
Well, there's also the question of, to the extent that these debates even matter, which we really don't have very compelling evidence that they do. So perhaps when we come back from this break, we will meditate on that, as well as Charles' expectations for Joe Biden in this first presidential debate when we return Beyond the Beltway. Eric Cohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman.
In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nia Hergaris with today's tip for kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. As parents, we want our children to grow up healthy and strong. That means helping teens take responsibility for their health as they become young adults. One way to do that is to make sure they have one-on-one time with their pediatrician. That helps them become comfortable talking about any health issue with their doctors and with you. So make sure to give your teen a voice. It's good for their health. For more on teen health, visit healthychildren.org.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
We are back on Beyond the Beltway. Eric Cohn, filling in this week for Bruce Dumont. Our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. To be a part of the program, give us a call. Let us know if you plan on watching the presidential debate on Thursday evening. What are your expectations for Joe Biden and Donald Trump? Let's get back to Charles Lipson. Charles, what are your expectations for Joe Biden? On one hand, yes, I think it is undeniable that Republicans can't resist the bait of always portraying Joe Biden as, you know, about ready to fall over. We've seen a lot of video clips of this in the last week or two of him looking like he's having senior moments. So on one hand, they are setting the expectations really, really low, but also after the fact, you know, they're going to try to apply whatever the highest expectations are that they can rip out of the debate and the dialogue. So what are your expectations for Joe Biden? What does he need to do in this debate?
Well, I think that the you nailed it, but I think that the way I would put it is this. They are making a major issue of Joe Biden's cognitive decline, not just his physical infirmity, but his cognitive decline. And they haven't piled on the second part of that, which is that people really don't want Kamala Harris to become president. And they will probably begin emphasizing that later. They can't, they can only temporarily pull their foot off of that accelerator prior to this debate. Right. I mean, in other words, that's been a constant theme. They can't all of a sudden say, no, we were just kidding. I think that the problem, and I've heard this from Republicans, Joe Biden's biggest problem is if he does something like he did the other day with Alejandro Mayorkas's name, where he couldn't remember the name and then started mumbling and it was utterly incoherent. And there have been a number of those. Democrats have said that some of the video clips have been fakes, cheap fakes, they call them, because they've been clipped out of context. That's true for some, but not true for all. And I think that the issue of Joe Biden's cognitive position will be very, very important in the whole thing. And I think what Trump will do is try to press him in very concrete ways about immigration and particularly some of these murders that have occurred recently. One final point. I think, and maybe you're going to bring this up, Eric, I think we're also looking for whether how fair the moderators are.
Well, perhaps let's go to this question then. There are some unique and interesting rules for this debate. Microphone muting being one of them. Each candidate's microphone will be muted while the other is speaking to prevent interruptions. Clearly, this is something that is aimed at avoiding what happened in the first presidential debate in 2020, where both Biden and Trump. Well, this is my question.
Yeah.
This is my question is I think it was requested. Well, who do you think really wanted this microphone muting? Do you think that it was the Biden team? Because I think you can make a compelling argument that Trump incentivized to act his most boorish is probably the best case as long as Joe Biden is able to not be rattled by it. So who do you think wanted this stipulation? Both agreed to it, but who do you think wanted it more? And what effect do you think it is going to have on the debate itself?
Well, in 2020, Trump blathered on. He wouldn't stop interrupting. He was like a machine. He just didn't know how to stop. And at one point, Joe Biden said, God, would you just shut up, man? And the pundits were apoplectic over that. They thought that Biden was unpresidential, unprofessional. But most of the voters loved it because they felt that way about Trump in that moment. So Biden actually had an opportunity to express something, albeit in somewhat crude terms, that millions of Americans were feeling. So the muted mic may help Trump because it's like a leash on him that prevents him from rubbing his nose in something rather unpleasant and then coming back into the house with a stain on his face. But the other question is if Trump, going back to Charles's term discipline, if Trump is undisciplined and he keeps talking when the mic is off, that's going to look even worse. And that's probably a real possibility. So it's very interesting. I think that it's better for the country, and I hope that it sets a precedent, because for a while now, debates have turned into shouting contests and a refusal to stop talking because of the fear that if one stops talking, they appear weak or kowtowed, when really, and these two aren't the best, far from it, to have this conversation, but a debate should be a serious discussion about policy and political procedure in which they have a respectful, albeit disagreeable and sometimes heated exchange.
Well, David, point me to Earth 2 where I can find that. But until we find a way to get there, I think we'll have to continue to focus on the actual debate that we're going to see that we expect to see on Thursday night. Charles, let me throw another wrinkle in this, another reason why this microphone muting thing may also, again, help Donald Trump. I was having a conversation with a friend. We were talking about presidential speech writing and just the idea that it's not as good as it used to be. And this person told me to go back and read some of the stuff that was written for George W. Bush in his first term, which, you know, is really some beautiful speech writing if you go back and you read it. The problem with George W. Bush is that, like, it was like watching a high wire act. You were always so concerned if he was going to stick the landing on the sentence that you had a hard time focusing on the actual words he was saying and the rhetoric that was being presented to you. So the question that I have is, Joe Biden, I think, kind of has a version of that problem where making sure his sentences don't wander off into nowhere when he is speaking a little more off the top of his head and not as much from a teleprompter. Is this, you know, having the microphone for Trump muted and the focus entirely on him, does this put more pressure on him to be able to present clear and coherent thoughts and it turn up the possibility that if he goes rambling off into some kind of a cul-de-sac, it looks all the more worse for him?
I completely agree with that. And I would say that it raises, it echoes the larger issue. I think in a lot of ways it's a negative election. Trump does have a large following that really want to vote for him. But I think that the election is being fought kind of in the middle, where the question is, who do you dislike the most? David really picked that up earlier and made the point. I'm just agreeing with what David said. That, how does that play out in the debate? I think that the more the focus is on Biden, in a lot of ways, the more that helps Trump. I should say, though, that all of these debates, they're really two dimensions to the debate. One is the debate itself, and we don't know how many people will watch, but I imagine it'll be very widely watched. But then the second is how the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, NBC, and all the rest play it, what clips they use, how they emphasize it, and so forth. And they've just been relentless, not only in attacking Trump, but in playing, downplaying issues that would hurt their guy, which is Biden. They're just active campaigners. So there's a second element to the debate, and that's the after debate. They used to just call it the spin room, but now it's a spin week.
David, the, you know, possibility of this debate changing the trajectory of this campaign seems rather limited. As you noted, a lot of people are unhappy with this choice. This seems, I think, one of the reasons why there's a debate this early in the presidential election cycle is the Biden team wants to remind people that, yes, Donald Trump is indeed the candidate that Joe Biden is running against. There's this belief, I think, that there's a lot of people who don't really fully accept yet that that's who this debate is between. So take their individual performances kind of out of it. A lot of it, you could argue, is baked into the cake. Do you think this starts to move some people in Joe Biden's direction once people are reminded, oh, yes, it is Donald Trump again? Or what do you think might happen?
Yeah, very quickly to your earlier point, Gore Vidal wrote that George W. Bush delivered his speeches with a great sense of discovery. So that's, I think, what you were trying to describe.
That's a good line.
But to your point, I do think it could help Biden if he's effective in setting up the contrast. If the Democratic candidate was Gavin Newsom or Gretchen Whitmer, I would have no doubt that it would help the Democrat, because you could hammer the guy that he's a convicted felon, he's an adjudicated rapist. He's very affectionate to both Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, January 6th, attempting to subvert an election, and on and on and on. I don't know if Biden has the capacity to pull that off. If he does, if he comes out aggressive and he maintains energy for 90 minutes and is effective in establishing that contrast, it will certainly help him. But to your earlier point, it's now a question what the electorate pays attention to at all, and if everything is baked into the cake, if the debate will move the needle one point or another in a direction.
Yeah, there's the possibility this could matter. There's the possibility it could not, which is probably true of everything. But this unpredictable presidential cycle, it seems to be even more true. We will continue to break that down and what to expect from Thursday's debate when we return. Beyond the Beltway, Eric Cohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont.
This is Seth Leibson for townhall.com. A new Gallup poll reveals that 32% of voters will vote exclusively for a candidate who shares their views on abortion. And pro-choice voters dominate that record-high finding. There's nothing wrong with being a single-issue voter, but our concern is that this cows pro-life candidates to play down their pro-life views. The truth is, Americans are evenly split on being pro-choice and pro-life. In fact, majorities and pluralities of Americans regularly identify as pro-life. Only one-third of Americans support abortion in every and all circumstances, which means late-term and based on nothing but caprice. That, however, is the Democratic Party position.
Ask Kamala Harris or Joe Biden or any Democrat running for office where they would put a limit on abortion. You will get stonewalled. They will not answer. That is the extreme position. Rather than hide, we should expose this gruesomeness more. Our party and country were founded to protect life. That is something to be proud of and speak more about, not less.
I think it's just vapor.
Vaping is safer than smoking, isn't it?
There's really not even that much nicotine in them, right?
One vape pod has as much nicotine as one pack of cigarettes.
My kid
knows it's dangerous.
5.4 million American kids vape, and most think it's harmless. Get your head out of the cloud. Talk to your kid about vaping. Visit talkaboutvaping.org. That's talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Matthew.
Sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No, thanks. I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for talking and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking.
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show him you love him. Keep him safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We're back on Beyond the Beltway. Eric Ohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont, and we have reached the prearranged portion of the program where we have our distinguished guests introduce themselves to all of you in the listening audience. I will start with myself as I'm filling in for Bruce this week. I am the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I encourage you to go check us out at acton.org. Of course, I will note that while I'm trying not to express any opinions myself this evening, any opinions I may express are mine and not those of my employer. I also encourage you to check out this documentary film I was involved in producing called The Hong Konger. It's about a man named Jimmy Lai, who is a political dissident in Hong Kong, currently on trial. You can find out more about that at freejimmylai.com if you want to check out that film, The Hong Konger. Let's start with our two distinguished guests this evening by starting with Charles Lipson.
Hi. I'm an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Chicago. My specialty has been international politics, and I've written a lot on that. I've also become increasingly interested in problems like free speech and the like, and I've got a number of books that are directed at undergraduate students to help them learn better, and I will have two books coming out in the next couple of weeks. One on free speech for students, and the other on what it means to do honest work and real learning in the age of artificial intelligence. There are a lot of works on both topics, free speech and AI, but there are none that are directed at students. And I've worked with students for many, many years, and I really wanted to do something that would help them.
Also joining us is David Masiotra. David, please tell us both about yourself, but please do tell us about your new book, Exurbia Now, The Battle for American Democracy.
Oh, thank you. Well, Walt Mittman once wrote, never sink so low to spend time with professors. And you have two times. Because, I teach at Indiana University Northwest in the English department and occasionally a political science course, introductory level. But yes, I am an author of several books, including my latest, Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. And that's a work of political geography that looks at what is not only the fastest growing part of the United States, which is exurbia. Exurbs are those towns further out on the fringes beyond the suburbs, not quite rural, but fewer people and greater distance from the metro area. But also the most politically volatile part of our country. So exurbia has really become the headquarters of the extreme right-wing movement, challenges to school boards, threats against libraries. Congress people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, Lauren Boebert, and other beacons of sanity represent districts that are predominantly exurban. So the book really draws on areas where I live. I live in Indiana, and I explore the Chicago suburbs and exurbs to attempt to give a political geography that will shed light on natural political issues. I also write regularly for the Washington Monthly, the New Republic, and a website on literature called Crime Reads.
David, going back to the subject of your book, how much do you see what is happening in exurbia being a part of this political realignment? I mean, typically, if you go back, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you start thinking of those smaller towns outside of the suburban areas. You probably would associate them more with Democratic Party politics than Republican Party politics. What has changed in those areas, and why are we seeing a shift in their politics as part of this greater political realignment we're currently experiencing?
That's a keen observation. One correction is exurbia, actually, the wealth is greater than median wealth across the United States, because these are often planned middle class and upper middle class communities, real estate developers go into largely undeveloped areas and they start putting up housing complexes, subdivisions, strip malls. But you're correct in that we once had something called prairie populism, which was a real boon to the left of the United States. It was anti-corporate. It supported candidates for office like Paul Wellstone in Minnesota. Even though George McGovern lost in such a landslide, he was a prairie populist. But now the characteristic of populism is becoming increasingly right wing. And it's not only skeptical of big business, but in very weird ways, but skeptical of institutions in general. So it gives rise to conspiracy theories and all kinds of thinking that really undermine our democracy, because our democracy depends upon some social cohesion mediated through faith and trust in our institutions and our civic organizations. And that's increasingly being lost. Local media is being lost. So these towns, as I said, are really breeding grounds for extreme forms of politics.
I want to remind you that our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That is 1-800-723-8289 to be a part of the program with us this evening. We've got a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. So I want to go now to Dave in Spokane, Washington. Dave, you're on Beyond the Beltway.
Hello, thanks for taking the call. I would really like to see this debate highlight the differences, like some of your guests have noted. But like for Trump, I think he just needs to highlight like the serial arsonist that Biden has been on just about every topic. I mean, if you look at what Iran has done, both in Israel and in the regard to their nuclear capabilities, both of those aspects have been helped by, guess what it takes, money. And when under Trump, they were down to less than around 200,000 barrels a day of oil, and the sanctions were being enforced on them. Biden gets into office, the sanctions are there, but they stopped enforcing them, and they've gone up to over 2 million barrels a day. And you know what that's generated in totality is about $100 billion that Iran has had to use on all these things we see happening around the world. he can hit on the border. Biden takes office, and the day right as he leaves the podium and to swear in, he goes and reverses all the stuff Trump had on the border just to spite Trump, because he doesn't want anything revolving Trump to exist. And now what do we see in the border? Every year of Biden's presidency, he's exceeded all 4 years of what the craziness that's coming across the border under Trump, including people who are known terrorists coming across the border. You see all these rapes and murders going on of people. This 12-year-old that just got brutalized and murdered, these are all on his watch. He caused this, and I hate when I hear, oh, well, the Congress needs to fix this. That's baloney. Trump had it way under control with the same exact laws, and by the way, H.R. 2 was passed by the House. The Senate could take it up and make some modifications if they wanted, but that bill was 10 times better than what came out of the Senate. So just call him out on everything.
Hey, Dave, I'm going to ask you to hold on there. There's a whole lot in what you just said. I'm going to go to Charles on this first and ask, let's back up to the beginning. You mentioned Iran. What foreign policy is to be a subject of this debate. To what extent do you think that it will be discussed, and how much do you think, what do you think it is going to focus on? I mean, the war in Israel and Gaza probably has to be the first thing that is going to come up with regard to the foreign policy subject matter.
Normally, foreign policy is not a voting issue for the public. It's a secondary kind of issue. I think that what concerns the public now is that the world seems to be in flames. It seems to be out of control, and the role of the U.S. seems to be substantially diminished. And it's unclear under the Biden presidency whether or not we are backing Israel, as over 70%+ of the public wants us to. That issue with Iran that the caller brought up is exactly right. Going back, the immigration issue, I think that the right way to think about the immigration issue is that it overlaps substantially with popular concerns about crime. And that's why, and I think that the black swan here is a potential terrorist attack. We simply don't know who's in the country now. We've had something over 8 million people come through who've had contact with the border, with our border patrol. But we have a huge number of gotaways, and on all of these issues, the Democrats are really split between the center left and the progressive left. There were demonstrations this week against AOC and Bernie because they actually endorsed Joe Biden for president. I think that's only a small group. But you do see people on the left calling Joe Biden a genocide Joe for giving any support to Israel. So I think it's a deep split within the Democratic Party. And I think you can see a pushback on not only Israel, but on what's happening on campus, on DEI, a lot of issues like that.
David, when we get back from the break, which we are coming up on rapidly here, I want to get your thoughts on what Charles just said and what Joe Biden can do within the context of this debate to try to shore up really, you know, both flanks that he has on the Israel-Gaza issue, his left that is unhappy with him for one reason, and people to his right anywhere who are unhappy with him for another. For that analysis, you'll have to come back to the program Beyond the Beltway. Bruce Dumont is out tonight. Eric Cohn filling in for Bruce this week. We'll be back shortly.
This is Dennis Prager. Sign up today for an unforgettable experience in Israel this October. Mike Gallagher and I are traveling to the Holy Land on the Stand with Israel tour with our trusted partner, Inspiration Cruises and Tours. This trip of a lifetime to Israel is one you don't want to miss. Register today before it's too late at StandWithIsraelTour.com, StandWithIsraelTour.com, or call 855-565-5519, 855-565-5519.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school? Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What if the music stopped? If the familiar voices were silenced? If there were no breaking news updates? What if your companion and connection to your community came with a monthly fee? Don't worry, we're free local radio with you wherever you go. Celebrating 100 years and looking forward to the next 100. We are broadcasters. Text radio to 52886 and let Congress know you depend on your local TV and radio stations. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and Ad Council.
We're back on Beyond the Beltway. Eric Cohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont. And our phone number is 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289 to join us on the program this evening. Let's go first back to our phones. We're going to go to Brian in Albuquerque. Brian, you're on Beyond the Beltway.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. Politically, I would call myself an independent. I don't like either party. But I would say that as far as this debate coming up in the election, never has so much rested on the shoulders of an 81-year-old man in American history. It's absolutely crazy. And I think the reason we've gotten to this position is because of the failures of both parties. Both of our parties are corrupt, ineffective, and incompetent. And I would like to say that you look at the Republicans, they have a criminal psychopath that's hijacked their party and is in complete control, and Lord knows what he's going to do. And then the Democrats, from dating all the way back to the Bill and Hillary Clinton era and their embrace of corporatism, globalism, and Wall Street, and they basically sold out America's working class. And the whole strategy with China has proven to be a failure. And the wealthy got extremely wealthy, and America's working class got the shaft. And that's why we're where we're at, because neither party will come clean on what's occurred to the body politic. And one of your commentators was talking about the world being on fire. Well, one of the principal architects is Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump's mentor, the ultimate strongman, someone Donald really loves and admires. And my final comment would be that if Biden can't move the needle and he just comes off looking like a tired, confused old man, I think they're going to swap him out. For the sake of all of humanity, he needs to bow out, claim he has a health issue, and let Gretchen Whitmer or somebody young and with vigor take over. We need a fresh face. I mean, the Democrats, I don't know why the hell they stuck with Biden. It's just It's insane.
And well, Kamala Brian, thank
Harris,
you.
You know, she is.
Brian, thank you for your. Brian, I want to get moving on here. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much for your call this evening. You are effectively teasing what I wanted to lead off with in hour number two, which is let's take for a given that Biden's performance in the debate is not going to be great. What might happen after that? But I do want to hold on for that conversation for when we are back at the top of hour number two. Let's stick with the phones for right now. Let's go back to the phones with Joy in San Diego. Joy, you're on Beyond the Beltway.
Oh, hi. Well, I was going to talk more about an issue versus the debate. Is that...
Go for it.
Okay, or did you want to stick on the debate?
Bring up the issue. What I mean, one of these issues could be an issue at the debate, so give it a chance. Let's see what we got here.
Well, I get so frustrated with the right when they talk about the crime coming from the southern border. And I know that there are risks, but they will talk about billions of money to be spent. You know, they'll take every measure so that a crime is not committed by an undocumented immigrant. But then we continue to have these massive shootings, and just the one in Arkansas. And as far as I can tell, the only response from the right is that we arm everybody. And I just find it so frustrating that we have this gun violence problem, but it doesn't have the same emphasis when you're looking at the right. And the numbers are just completely different. About the risks to people day to day of what, you know, what's happening if you go to a grocery store or to a school or to a theater.
Joy, thank you so much for your call. Charles, we'll go to you on this. I mean, what you had mentioned previously, I think it was you who had said that the issue of crime and immigration are somewhat entangled with each other. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they're entangled for two reasons. One is that there is a lot of crime that's associated with, I don't call it undocumented. The problem isn't that they lack a document. The problem is that they came into the country illegally. And I got to tell you that they're all over the place in Chicago. I mean, you just can't go anywhere in any neighborhood without running into a lot of people who are begging on the streets and so forth. And they usually have their children there with them and so forth. So one of the issues has to do with actual crime. The other issue has to do with what looks like a confused sense of enforcing the law. So I think that an open southern border overlaps in a lot of people's minds with the Soros DAs that don't prosecute anything and Alvin Bragg lets students take over Columbia. By the way, I think that they'll take over Columbia. There's a real question of whether they can reopen the school in the fall, and these issues are going to be on the table.
I want to get David in here real quick before the end of the hour. Is there an issue that Joe Biden has to press other than Donald Trump's character? What normal issue is really to his advantage, do you think, in this debate?
He's had some successes, but people don't know about them. Presidents since the 1980s have talked about lowering prescription drug costs. Biden succeeded. There's now a cap for Medicare patients on prescription drug costs. The infrastructure program, bipartisan, is a success. But I just don't think in the era of these extreme culture wars and short attention spans that those will register with the voting public. So it's a very difficult issue for him. And plus, people rightly or wrongly feel the economy is bad, and it's not a good look for a president to say your feelings are wrong, vote for me. So he has quite
a challenge.
And abortion,
he'll run on abortion.
Oh, yes. Yes, very good. Yes, yes, that's a key issue. That's been a treasure for the Democrats. And Republicans
certainly,
getting more and more extreme in their opposition to abortion.
Yeah, David, I gotta say there was something just absolutely you know, I don't mean this dismissively, but quaint in the way that you talked first about prescription drug prices. It like takes us back to an era of politics that just does not seem to exist anymore. Like the idea of anybody bragging in a presidential debate about I was the guy who lowered prescription drug prices just seems like a bygone era. Still a lot more about this debate to unpack. We will do so when we are back on Beyond the Beltway. Eric Cohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont. We're back in hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Eric Cohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont. And in the first hour, we were talking with our guest Charles Lipson, political scientist and professor emeritus from the University of Chicago, and David Masiotra, a commentator and author of Exurbia Now, The Battle for American Democracy. We're also pleased now to be joined in the second hour here by Pat Reddy. Pat is a Democratic political consultant and an author coming to us from California, coming to us by phone. We've been talking primarily, Pat, about the upcoming debate, but let me get you in here with the question of where do you see the state of this presidential race coming in to this first debate, and what are your expectations for this first debate?
Well, I've got good news for political junkies. I think that if the election were today, it would be so close that we could see Florida-style recounts in four or five states. The press will love it. I don't know if the people will, but it's that close. I mean, it's going to be a few thousand votes in five or six states either way. That's the way it's been the past two elections. We're basically having trench warfare elections. And David is, you know, writing about Exurbia. He's right to do that because suburbia is now the battleground. And so we have a distinction between the inner ring suburbs like in Cook County that are becoming more Democratic because they're aging and getting the problems more like a city. And then, you know, we're getting the new suburbia that's, you know, out in the countryside and is, you know, changing greatly. My expectations for the debate is I think it's just going to be another slugfest. And they're just going to rip each other and attack each other, and just like they did last time. I know one of the things that's on your mind is if Biden bombs disastrously, is it going to be a move to replace him? One of the other guests brought that up. It could happen. I give it a 10% chance of happening. You know, I still say the perfect ticket for the Democrats would be a combination of Gavin Newsom and Michelle Obama, probably with Michelle as the presidential candidate and Gavin as the vice presidential candidate, but she doesn't want to do it, obviously. But she's, you know, she would definitely get out the black vote and the minority vote, and Gavin would lock up the West. So I think they could win. Probably not going to happen, but, so, you know, we'll see how Biden does. That's the $100,000 question. You know, we know Trump will be Trump. He'll be his usual loud and bombastic self. It's a New York City thing, and I know because I grew up there. So, yeah, I mean, it should be fun to watch.
So Pat says 10% chance, in his opinion, going into this debate, that one of the outcomes is a move to replace Joe Biden as the presidential nominee. Let's go around the horn on this one, Charles. What percentage chance do you give it that a disastrously bad performance from Joe Biden would lead to some kind of interesting, you know, behind the curtain political intrigue heading into the Democrat convention and the chance that they may replace him at the top of the ticket? Like, you're on mute, Charles. While Charles is getting that figured out, David, why don't we go ahead and start with you on the same question?
I think the chances are very low because it's too late right now. You have the question of raising money. You have the question of...
Do you really think it'd be a problem raising money for any new candidate, again, when the other person they're opposing is Donald Trump?
I mean, that's a good point, yeah, but... I do think it would be a problem. It's so late, and perhaps an even bigger problem is finding, I wish that Biden would have stepped down gracefully and that the Democratic Party could have had a robust primary. But it's going to become a real challenge to find a candidate who could please both wings of the party, because the progressive left has gone completely bonkers on a number of issues, Israel being the first and foremost. And the center left, which is really has some excellent candidates and a great bench, they would have to run into almost a MAGA-like left wing of the party that at this stage would make replacing Joe Biden terribly difficult.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, Charles. But real quick for David, okay, before we come back to you.
Okay.
You'd mentioned earlier when we were abstractly talking about this possibility that the first names that you brought up were Gavin Newsom and Gretchen Whitmer. I noticed not Kamala Harris. So do you think that that person just is not or could not be Kamala Harris? Is it immediately going to be other people being considered? And what do you think that will do to the Democratic Party to have the first black female vice president be overlooked if that were to happen?
It would be disastrous. So I don't have any objections to Kamala Harris. I suppose I'm in the minority because she's become this punching bag in our political culture for reasons I don't understand. But as the cliche goes, perception is politics, and she's very unpopular. So that would put Democrats behind the eight ball. They could select someone who is very unpopular for fair or unfair reasons, or they could alienate and aggravate to no end black voters, women voters, and especially the combination black women voters who are essential to the Democratic base, especially in swing states like Michigan and Georgia and others.
Charles, now that we got you back, what percentage chance do you think it is that one of the outcomes here is that we are looking at a new nominee for the Democratic Party?
When people talk about Joe Biden not doing well in the debate, I think we need to distinguish two different kinds of not doing well. One are the kind of ordinary, you lose the debate, you didn't have a good answer on immigration, or your answer on the economy is less good than Trump's, whatever. I don't think that, I think that hurts Biden, but I don't think that it leads to any movement that could possibly succeed in pushing him out. What could is if he has a real cognitive freeze of some sort, some kind of gap that lets people think, I think that this guy, I wouldn't let this guy drive my daughter to a concert practice. I'm not going to let him run the country. That's a very different kind of thing. And in that case, and in fact, I've actually heard Republicans say that they hope, just for partisan reasons, he doesn't have that because they think he's a weak candidate to run against. I think that they underestimate what a complete S-show it would be if you had to replace the president of the United States. And there are no primaries that would lead to that. So it would look like the nominee was airlifted in. And as David said, you've got an African American in the number two position, and this is a party that lives on identity politics. They would have a real problem.
Yeah, the Democratic Party would be in a very interesting position, but it would be for the first time in a long time, convention intrigue and actual, like, backroom politics that we don't get anymore. And it would at least be the most unpredictable and interesting thing in this race that seems very predictable and uninteresting in a lot of ways. Eric Cohn, filling in this week for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway.
As a local business owner, you get called every week by marketing companies. We get it. We have hundreds of satisfied customers. Here's what a satisfied client recently said.
Open enrollment is going great. We're hitting record numbers. Thank you so much for this report. It really is amazing to see how the marketing is really shaping our enrollment around the city.
If you're a local business and ready for the next step, visit surroundchicago.com right now. Our experts are ready to help you take your marketing to the next level. Visit surroundchicago.com today.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Vodi Bonkam examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide. Available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Eric Owen, filling in for Bruce Dumont, as we are back on Beyond the Beltway this Sunday evening. We've been primarily talking about the debate, and Pat Reddy, who's joining us here for the second hour, had also given his take on the state of the race and just how razor close he thinks it is. Before coming back to Pat, I wanted to get Charles and David in here on where they think the presidential race is at this point. How close do you think it is? And particularly, I want another question you would address in there too is, you know, this idea was, you know, a Florida-like recount. You know, I'm recalling myself now what it was like in that period of time when Florida was being recounted in 2000. I'm remembering what I thought was a the adorably quaint thought that was the 2004 presidential election was a pretty contentious one. Could we survive? You know, how much toleration is there in the political, you know, health of this country to tolerate multiple recounts like that, given what happened in the last 4 years in this country? So what's the state of the race? And could we handle a scenario like that, Charles?
Well, those are two different questions. The first question is, it looks very tight right now. The latest polls put Biden up slightly. But those are national polls, and the swing state polls generally put Trump up, but they're pretty close to the margin of error. So we just don't know. Right now, I would say it's Trump has the edge in the electoral count. On whether we could survive recounts, I think that the problem links back to something that David was saying earlier in the first hour, which is that there's been an erosion of faith in our institutions. If you look back at polling from just before the Vietnam War and Watergate, 70% of American public said that they had faith in American institutions. And now the numbers look like the same numbers who have faith in used car dealers. I mean, it's just awful. And the only institution that has public approval above 50% is the U.S. military. So which is not a good thing in a democracy. You want public to have faith in the military, but you want it to have faith in the civil institutions that oversee the military. So this is a very serious problem. And both sides have attacked it. The Republicans will say, look, the Democrats wanted to pack the Supreme Court. They've changed this rule and that rule and so forth. And they suppressed information in the last election. And then the Democrats will say January 6th. They'll say we have a president who still hasn't acknowledged he lost the last election. And the fact is both sides are right. That is, both sides have been attacking very fundamental institutions of the United States.
I would be remiss if I didn't take an opportunity to talk my own book here and point out that at the Acton Institute, there's a fantastic essay being published tomorrow morning by Christine Rosen from the American Enterprise Institute on the question of, can Americans learn to trust again? Like, what is the path out of a low trust society? You can find that at acton.org. It's part of the first lead essay from our magazine, Religion and Liberty. So I encourage people to go check that out there, acton.org, tomorrow morning. David, I mean, the same questions to you. Like, where do you see the state of this race currently? And again, imagine that recount scenario. You know, what would America look like, and how are we capable of handling something like that?
Right now, I would give Biden a slight edge in the election only because, and this could change by the time we roll around in November, but Trump's polls have begun to decline since his conviction. I think it matters more than conventional wisdom in the media purports. And also the X factor of the Nikki Haley voters, 10 to 20% of Republicans in many of these primary states, even after Nikki Haley dropped out of the race, are continuing to vote for her. If even a small fraction of those voters stay home or even turn out for Biden in swing states, that would be disastrous for Trump. To your other question, you know, it's a powder keg. It's a tinderbox. It's a stack of dynamite, whatever dangerous sounding metaphor you want to use. We have one candidate in a race right now who not only tolerates but often encourages political violence and a media network surrounding him that also encourages political violence, and it's manifested in threats against school board members, election workers, librarians, various educational employees. And that, I believe, is currently the greatest threat against our democracy and the stability of our society. And those people would come out in full force if we had Florida-like recounts. But I will also mention that, you know, I'm wearing this ribbon tonight in solidarity with Israel and the hostages. And I thought it was important to do that as someone who's left of center, because what we've seen in this explosion of anti-Semitism and this rush to behave with their own form of violence among the anti-Israel protesters demonstrates that there is that capacity on the left as well. And I don't know how we get out of this mess where we have these warring factions of extremes threatening the stability of our society. But we have to find a way to do it, and leadership has to get us there, because there's a real disconnect between every day I meet Americans who are wonderful people, and yet our political culture appears psychotic.
Pat Reddy, you were the one who raised the recount in 2000 when giving me the state of the race here. I bring that last question back to you. And how do you think we would handle a situation like that with recounts, maybe not just in one state, but in many states?
Well, it would be Florida on steroids. It could get scary. I mean, in 1876, which was, of course, a fiercely contested contested election, the slogan by the Democrats for their nominee was, it's Tilden or war. And that was in the aftermath of the Civil War. So, you know, you saw what happened on January 6th. I mean, it could easily turn violent if, you know, one side thought that, you know, the process was rigged or they were cheated. Yeah, it could get ugly really quick.
I think that there's going to be violence at both conventions. And as I said, there's a black swan possibility of terrorism between now and the election. The year I really remember was 1968 when there were assassinations. So we have had periods of violence. And I think the problem with the recount is that nobody trusts that we're only counting valid ballots that cast by people who are eligible to count them. There's been so much erosion of trust in that basic system. I do believe that we would be better off going back to paper ballots. You can count them electronically, but then you would have a paper trail. And I think that that could give greater confidence. I think people don't have any confidence that the machines can't be hacked. We saw last time crazy conspiracy theories about the machines being hacked and all the rest.
Yeah, Charles, I think we are – I want to go back to the point you made about political violence at the conventions. Of course, you mentioned 1968. It is again in Chicago, the Democratic National Convention. I think the presumption
is
that you're likely
in Chicago.
They will stop returning there if it happens twice like this. I think the presumption there is that the political violence would come from the political far left at the Democratic Convention, not from the political far right. Do you think that it would be also violence from the far left at the Republican Convention, or do you think that it would be from somewhere else?
I think it's coming from the far left on both sides, unless, and this could very well happen, you have these right-wing groups that know that there's going to be violence. They look for a chance to fight, and they could come into town too. You've got really decimated police forces in cities like Chicago. And, of course, you have prosecutors who don't prosecute. Now, the prosecutor here has said, oh, I'm going to change my policy for the last 4 years. I'm going to actually prosecute people if they create problems at the Democratic National Convention. But who knows? I mean, but there are promises of real violence.
David, I think you want to get in here with a thought on that.
Yes. Yeah, I would add to that that, you know, we're at the end of Pride Month, and nearly every state has reported, law enforcement in nearly every state has reported acts of violence and vandalism against various Pride displays and events. So there's certain, and that's all from the right. And the Proud Boys recently announced that they're coming back on their social media. So there's also the danger of violence from far right groups as well. And as the Pride Month reports indicate, it's already happening.
Yeah, I think the theory might be that, you know, there's more of an opportunity for some kind of a clash or confrontation between groups from the left and the right, probably at the Republican convention, but more likely something like 1968 all over again between a police force in Chicago and protesters in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. But the difference is this is not Daddy Daly's Chicago anymore. And what the police force that is going to be meeting those people is going to be like and how they will act given that new reality, the new reality of Chicago, is really an unanswered question and something that we will only find out later this year when that convention happens in Chicago. We will, of course, keep you up to date on that on this program. Eric Cohn filling in this week for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway.
In the new video series, Fault Lines, Professor Voddie Baucham examines the threat of woke social doctrine versus biblical justice.
The religion of anti-racism has no redemption. We have to be right about what God requires in this critical moment.
Discover the fault lines beneath today's cultural divide.
What God are you trying to appease?
Fault Lines, the 10-part video series and essential 6-part study guide, available at salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We are back on Beyond the Beltway. Eric Owen filling in this week for Bruce Dumont. And we are being joined in this second hour by Pat Reddy. Pat, this is the corresponding part in the second hour of the program to where we have our guests introduce themselves to the people listening. So give you a chance now to introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, where you're from, and what you do.
Yes, I live in Santa Monica, California. I've been a Democratic political consultant for the past 30 years out here. I'm writing, like your fellow guests, I'm writing a couple books. The first one's called 21st Century America, How Suburbanites, Immigrants, and High-Tech Voters Will Choose Our Presidents. That one should be out next spring. I go back to 1928 and look at ethnic, regional, racial, class, ideological voting patterns for president over the past century. And then after that, hopefully I'll have another book out called Election Battleground about city, suburban, and rural voting. I'll take a look at David's exurbia. And Bruce Dumont would like both of them because they'll be about America beyond the Beltway. So,
well, excellent. Looking forward to both of those books. Let me ask you, since the last time these two candidates got together for a debate, Donald Trump has now been convicted of a number of felony counts. He is a convicted felon. And Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, is now a convicted felon as well. I think it is a guarantee that these two trials and the convictions are going to come up in the debate on Thursday. to what extent do you think they mattered? Less what do you think they're going to say about them at the debate, but do these matter to voters? Does the Hunter Biden conviction take any of the sting out of the Trump conviction? And what do you think they're going to mean to this presidential race?
Well, you know, the election is going to be decided by such a small fraction of voters. I mean, Trump won by Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by 78,000 votes in 2016. Biden won them back by, I think, 45,000 votes in 2020. Really hard to say because it's just such a small amount of voters. You know, they're going to decide this election. You know, Trump has been a great turnout machine for both parties. But you wonder if all this negative stuff, like you said, about Trump being convicted and Hunter Biden, if that might squeeze turnout down a little in this election, which, again, could have a huge impact on these closely divided states. So, I mean, my stock answer to anything is, in the age of Donald Trump, anything is possible. So...
yes, certainly there's an element of unpredictability to all of this and of, you know, things being unprecedented as well. You know, we've never had a circumstance like this. David, I want to get you in on this. These legal problems for one and the actual candidate, but the son of the other candidate, not the same, but not good. What effect do you think this is going to have on the race? You know, is this the kind of thing that is all baked into the cake, or are voters going to actually be in some way affected by the legal problems around both of these two candidates for office?
Trump's legal problems matter much more. And, you know, it's difficult to trust polls. I did some research before the program, and the national polls at this point in the race were wrong 6 out of the last 11 elections. So unless we're talking baseball, that's a pretty bad ratio, 6 for 11. However, a large percentage of Republicans, 20 to 30%, said they would not vote for Trump if he was convicted of any of the crimes with which he was charged. Now, we know realistically that number will shrink down. But even if it's 3, 4, or 5%, that is devastating to the Trump campaign. Whereas the Hunter Biden story has been a favorite on the right for a long time, but I don't think it resonates at all with the people that Biden needs to bring to the polls and the people with whom he's having some difficulty right now, black voters, Latino voters, and young voters. I don't think they're tuned in to the various struggles and travails of Hunter Biden.
Yeah, Charles, David brings up a really good point there, which is whether it is represented by the people who continue to vote for Nikki Haley even after she had dropped out of the Republican primary, the people who have expressed that they would not vote for Donald Trump if he was a convicted felon, they all don't have to be people who follow through on what they said that they were going to do there. Because I think Pat is correct that this is going to be such a close election, just like the previous two were, tens of thousands of votes in 3 or 4 states being what decides this. Any people falling away from Donald Trump is a huge problem for his campaign. Do you think that there's anything they can do to make up for any of those people that may be falling away for those reasons?
I think that the campaign is not only trying to make up to for them, but I think it's trying to do something different. I think it's trying to win Hispanic votes and maybe some black votes to compensate for it. The point about polling is interesting because I think Pat Reddy is exactly right, and David has been too, that it's not that the polls really are bad. It's that no poll can tell you the yes-no outcome in Pennsylvania or Georgia if we have a 10,000 vote margin. You just can't get that even if you sampled very deeply in that state. And so I I think on the trials, I don't think that the Hunter trial hurts Joe Biden at all on the guns. I think that the income tax trial does if Hunter doesn't plead it out. I also think that Judge Marchion could vastly overstep if he puts Trump in prison or restricts his ability to move around. The fact that Trump is still under a partial gag order is absolutely ridiculous. Who's being, I mean, you know, the case has been decided. I think that people who are outside the Republican orbit don't understand how absolutely furious Republicans are about the lawfare. They know that this case would not have been brought in New York against anybody who wasn't named Donald Trump. And even Andrew Cuomo just said that on television. So a lot of people just think it was not fair, and they think that this judge didn't give fair instructions.
Pat, do you agree with that? That it was not this case would not have been brought against anybody other than Donald Trump?
Probably. The district attorney there was elected as a partisan Democrat. So yes, that's probably true. But Mr. Lipson makes an excellent point that, you know, polls cannot measure this race because it's just too close. And, you know, polls have a 3-5% margin of error, and the margins in these states was less than 1%. So, you know, even if you sampled 100,000 people, you still might not get it right. You know, William Goldman, the Oscar-winning screenwriter, used to say about judging movies in advance that nobody knows anything. And my former boss, Bill Snyder, says it's true about this election. We're just in such uncharted territory, and Trump is such a unique figure. You know, there's a lot of Trump voters who will not tell the truth to a pollster because they just don't trust them, getting back to your idea of trust. So there's a hidden reservoir of Trump support. We just don't know how big it is. And it showed up twice in national elections, and it's probably out there again now. So Mr. Goldman's correct. Nobody knows anything. And like I said before, we may not know anything till Thanksgiving because it may take that long to sort out the count, the recount, and then the lawsuit.
There's one more element.
Charles, I want to get David in here because he had something from a moment ago. So David, go ahead.
I just want to add, even though it's a different state and a different era, the Trump case essentially was brought against someone else, John Edwards, for committing the exact same crime in the 2008 race. And Edwards wasn't even acquitted. It was a mistrial as a result of a hung jury. So, you know, to quote Gore Vidal for the second time tonight, he called our country the United States of amnesia. I think many people have forgotten that Edwards, a Democrat, who was a rising star in the Democratic Party before his despicable behavior became public, was charged and prosecuted with the exact same crime, and it was a hung jury. He wasn't even acquitted.
Charles, real quick, about 30 seconds.
There were two misdemeanors that were strung together, together with an unnamed underlying crime, a felony, that I think is unprecedented. And in fact, there are a number of reversible errors. The point I was going to make that is also different from last time, is I think that the Republicans have worked on getting a turnout machine this time that's better than they've had in the past. The Democrats have done a good job on that, and I think that the Republicans are trying to learn from them. They also are not giving up the early vote this time. The Republicans aren't. Whether they can succeed as well as Democrats in getting an early vote is another matter.
That is an interesting question, especially for as much time as Donald Trump spent inveighing against mail-in voting, early voting, any kind of voting other than voting on Election Day. It will be interesting to watch and see to what extent he changes that message and the Republican messaging on that changes as we get closer to Election Day. We will be back in just a few minutes. Eric Cohn filling in for Bruce Dumont this week on Beyond the Beltway. I'll be here.
to hear what's on your mind.
Kids want to share what's going on in their lives with the adults around them. Parents, grandparents, teachers, coaches, and more. They want to know you're listening, and they want to listen to you. They want your input and guidance, early and often, on all kinds of topics. When it comes to a serious subject like underage drinking, they want to know your expectations, as well as how and why, as a young person, they should avoid alcohol. How you talk about it will change as your child grows, but the important thing is to talk about it. Not just once for an hour when you think the time is right, but in 60 one-minute conversations and more that are part of your everyday talks. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. When you need me, I'll be by your
side. No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably?
It's been 23 minutes since I ate.
I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Here we are back on Beyond the Beltway. Eric Cohn filling in for Bruce Dumont this week. And we have spent most of this program talking about the upcoming presidential debate. So I figure this is probably a good place to close the conversation. I'll ask all three of you this question. Does this matter at all? We really have only had presidential debates since 1960. And as it strikes me, these are mostly moments where we mythologize presidential campaigns and build storytelling around them, starting in 1960 with the idea that people who watched it on TV thought Kennedy won and people who listened to it on the radio thought Nixon won and that Nixon lost because he looked like he was sweating and unshaven, to, you know, Reagan in 1980 with There You Go Again, or Reagan in 1984 with not exploiting Mondale's youth and inexperience. These are less moments that change the trajectory of those campaigns, or at least it's widely believed. Charles is the political scientist. He could tell us what he thinks of that. Then they are moments we just kind of point to as inflection points in storytelling. So, Charles, I'll start with you there. Do these debates really matter at all, other than they are moments after the fact we can go and construct part of the narrative around and use them as ways of explaining what happened to come afterwards?
I think that they can matter. I think that they can matter if there's a terrible flub or somebody really dunks on the other candidate. The clearest example of that was when Dan Quayle was forever banished from the first tier by Lloyd Benson, who said he knew. I mean, he was clearly prepared for that moment. I think that the big danger actually is making a mistake in the debate. And the level of debate between Kennedy and Nixon will put to shame whatever we see this time. I mean, those are two very intelligent, well-informed on policy, and I hope that that's what we get. I think that debates can also matter if they, if you got a candidate who's new to the big time to show he or she is really ready for the job. And I think that will be an issue for whoever Donald Trump picks as his vice presidential candidate.
David, I'll throw the same question to you. Does it matter? But also give you an opportunity here, since Charles kind of brought it up, and we had referenced it earlier, to wax poetic about the sad decline of presidential rhetoric over the years.
Yeah, I think that if it reinforces a prevailing notion that's already existent in our political culture. So start with a historical example, in 92, there was the idea that George H.W. Bush was a patrician and out of touch with the electorate, and Bill Clinton was a man of the people. And there was a moment in one of the debates, I won't bother going through the entire thing, that really enforced that for all of the audience. Similarly, in 2020, there was the idea that Donald Trump was unhinged. He was a bit of a lunatic. He wasn't a disciplined leader. And when he kept interrupting and talking over Biden, it reinforced that. The decline of presidential rhetoric is really quite tragic. We've gone from Kennedy-esque poetic speechifying and oratory into what sounds like the soundtrack of a Beavis and Butthead episode. And in fact, there are studies demonstrating that presidential candidates now speak at a fourth grade level. So Neil Postman, a great social critic, titled a book of his Amusing Ourselves to Death. And it does feel as if we're laughing all the way to the grave. And this speaks to your larger question of, do the debates matter? If we have an electorate that's increasingly uninformed, and we have an electorate that's increasingly unable to follow difficult policy discussions, what is the purpose of the debate other than an exercise in middle school theater?
Pat Reddy, same question to you. Do these debates matter at all?
They can. I agree with David. They tend to push voters in the direction they were leaning. For instance, in 1960, a lot of non-Catholic Democrats were leaning towards JFK, but they just weren't sure. Then they saw him on TV and said, hey, we really like him, and they ended up voting for him. Probably in 1980, people were going to vote against Carter, but they were undecided about Reagan, and he gives this nice performance, you know, and says, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And, you know, you get a landslide for Reagan. I think with, as both of your guests have made clear, though, with Biden's unique because, you know, there's doubts about his age, which, you know, is a problem. So he could, you know, he could either settle that by performing well, or as we discussed before, if he just has a moment where he freezes, like, well, the famous one was Rick Perry, the governor of Texas in 2012. I think he took 47 seconds to answer a question, and it was just blank screen time, and it wrecked his campaign. So if that were to happen to Biden, I think Professor Lipson's correct.
And Perry also famously said that he would eliminate three branches or three departments of the federal government. And the moderator said, which three? And he could only name two.
Yes, the
two out of three ain't bad.
Right. You know, hey, from I said I would refrain from editorializing, but it's the end of the program, and you know, the decided libertarian me says, you know, if we could get two, that would be fine. I'll let go the third one if we could just get the first two taken care of. But by the time this program airs again next Sunday, there likely will have been the first presidential debate, and Bruce and whoever is on that program with him will have the opportunity to break down what actually happened and what they think it actually will mean for the 2024 presidential election as we move forward to November. I want to thank Charles Lipson. I want to thank David Masiotra. I want to thank Pat Reddy for joining us on the program this evening. Thanks so much to Bruce Dumont for the opportunity to sit behind the microphone. I'm Eric Cohn, filling in this week for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. We will be back. Bruce, hopefully, will be back with you next Sunday for more analysis from Beyond the Beltway.